From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A historic week in Washington as resurgent Democrats took back control of the House with the most diverse congressional class in history. And as Nancy Pelosi, the first woman to be elected Speaker of the House, secured the Speaker's gavel once more.
When our new members take the oath, our Congress will be refreshed and our democracy will be strengthened by their optimism, idealism, and patriotism of this transformative freshman class.
Optimistic indeed. Democrats in the House voted to reopen government agencies closed in the partial federal shutdown by passing a bill that notably did not include any money for President Trump's beloved border wall. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he won't bring the bill to the Senate floor.
Let's not waste the time. Let's not get off on the wrong foot with House Democrats using their platform to produce political statements rather than serious solutions.
And so the partial shutdown continues, nearing the end of its second week. But things are still moving along here at On Point. Join us. What do you expect from this historic new Congress? And how important is the battle over the border wall to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Or you can hit me up on Twitter. At David Folkenflik is my handle. With us from Washington is Sung Min Kim. She's a White House reporter for The Washington Post and covers the Trump administration through the lens of Capitol Hill. Sung Min, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David.
And also with us, I'm really pleased about this, from Washington is Janet Hook. She's a veteran Washington reporter who recently rejoined the resurgent Los Angeles Times. She's completing her first week on the job as a national political reporter there. I remember Janet from her days on Capitol Hill in the 90s. And when I was a Cub reporter there, Janet, great to talk with you once more.
Oh, thanks, David. It's great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Sung Min, and Janet.
So, Sung Min, set the scene for us. It was quite a moment yesterday in the House floor in particular, the new House of Representatives being sworn in. I believe a young woman was flossing on the floor of the House. Set the scene for us. What was it like?
Well, the first day of a new Congress is always really fun. I mean, there does seem to be this first day of school feeling. Obviously, existing members haven't seen each other often in a few days or a few weeks, so people are catching up. There are a lot of new faces. There are the incoming members are excitedly looking around the Capitol, sometimes getting lost in the corridors of the Capitol. They're with their families and their friends for this momentous day of getting sworn in. So it's really a fun moment on Capitol Hill. There's always the drama of a speaker vote, but we've known for several weeks now that Nancy Pelosi had sewn up the votes to be speaker despite a rocky start where it looked like she had a pretty significant faction against her assuming the speaker's gavel once again. But it was such an unusual first day of Congress, where other previous inaugural days have been full of pomp and circumstance and not much else. But yesterday, the Democrats had to dive in right immediately into a pretty serious issue, the fact that the government has been shut down now for 2 weeks, and to move on a pretty major move to try to reopen the government. Now, this move is dead on arrival in the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has said he's not going to take up any legislation that the president does not plan to sign. But it did cast kind of this shadow over what is usually kind of a fun day on Capitol Hill.
So earlier this week, before she was sworn in, Pelosi sat down with Savannah Guthrie of NBC on the Today Show, and she talked a little bit about thinking about dealing with President Trump and thinking about particularly trying to negotiate with the president. Here's what she had to say.
When you're negotiating with someone, you have to know, you stipulate to some fact. It's hard to do that with the president because he resists science, evidence, data, truth. It's hard to pin the president down on the facts. I think and hope that we can work together in a positive way now that the president is more acclimated to the fact that he's dealing with a Democratic majority in the Congress of the United States.
And speaking a little bit to the question of truth, here's what the president had to say about the border wall during an impromptu appearance in the White House press room yesterday.
I have never had so much support as I have in the last week over my stance for border security, for border control, and for, frankly, the wall or the barrier.
Now, to be clear, a recent poll by the Center for American Political Studies at Harvard found that 56% of respondents did not support the president's proposal to construct that wall along the southern border, even as a majority of voters did believe security along the southern border is a concern. Jenna Hook, I want to focus on the issue that Pelosi raised and then the dynamic that President Trump evokes, which is that in her thinking about negotiation, she says it's hard to negotiate with somebody who doesn't operate from a set of facts and then doesn't stick with the beliefs they have. Janet Hook, Nancy Pelosi, an extremely wily legislator, how is she going to deal with this administration as she moves forward?
Well, that's a really good question. And she raises a really important point about Washington in general is that everybody's a little bit confused, even Trump's own party, about how to deal with Trump's in terms of negotiating, just because not only does his command of the facts are his facts sometimes in question, but people kind of don't know where he stands on things because he changes his position so often. So not the ideal negotiator. And actually, contrary to what Pelosi said, I'm not so sure that Trump has yet come to grips with the fact that the House is controlled by Democrats. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was having enough trouble with Congress when it was controlled by his own party. And now I think you can't overstate what a big difference it makes to have Democrats in control of one chamber. They may not be able to get their way on things. They may not pass their own agenda, but they can just throw up roadblocks that Trump just hasn't run into before.
To your point, a listener from Wisconsin says, you know, Trump had a Republican Congress for 2 years, couldn't get border wall passed. What makes him think he can get one now with a Democratic House, right?
Right. And I think that the part of the problem for him isn't just that the Democrats control the House, but also I think in this particular face-off, you're seeing signs of, well, shall we say, cracks in the political wall of his own party among Senate Republicans. There's already some uneasiness among Republicans who will be up for re-election in 2020 about it's time to get this shutdown over with.
Mm-hmm. There's something about the nature of this particular House that's been – and this House majority of Democrats that's been ushered in that is interesting. Pelosi spoke to that in a talk that she gave shortly before she was sworn in.
I'm particularly proud to be the woman Speaker of the House of this Congress, which marks the 100th year of women having the right to vote. And we all have the ability and the privilege to serve with over 100 women members of Congress, the largest number in history.
Jack Beatty, my colleague Susan Davis, tweeted about how remarkable it was to see the new Democratic majority with so many women legislators and so many lawmakers of color, and seeing what she described as a tableau on the Republican side of almost entirely white men. It seems to me that it's got to affect the nature and the equilibrium of how the House operates in some ways.
Yes, you almost have two different parties there. And what's striking is the sort of look at it historically. 30 years ago, 1989, there were 16 women Democrats and 13 women Republicans in the House. 30 years later, there are 89 women Democrats and the same number, 13 women Republican representatives. And this follows, in fact, what the preferences of GOP voters. Only one in three Republicans believe there are too few women in politics. Only one in three, compared to 8 in 10 Democrats who think there are too few women in politics. So it's as if there's the old distinction between the mommy party and the daddy party seemed to be quite in evidence there in the House as you looked at that, as the camera panned the room.
Janet Hook, you've covered a number of election cycles in which it were proclaimed to be the year of the woman. Is there something different at this time with Pelosi, with the gavel, with such a strong complement of women lawmakers? Or is this, you know, ultimately, does everyone get mainstreamed and does Washington enforce certain kinds of norms?
No, this is a really different freshman class. And I think 2018 was a year of the woman. I mean, the goal is for there to be every year to be a woman's year as well as a man's year. But so in this particular cycle, though, there were not only record-breaking numbers of women running for Congress, there were record-breaking numbers of women running at all levels of government. They ended up with more than 100 in the House for the first time. But also, for the Democratic Party, the votes of women were crucial. And I think that's what has enhanced the political status of women as much as the increased number in the Congress. It was fun to watch Nancy Pelosi up on the dais after she won as Speaker for the second time. And she did what she did the first time she was elected Speaker, is that she made her closing remarks surrounded by all the children in the chamber. Mm-hmm. And when she did that the first time, that was really, it was eye-popping. And it was eye-popping again this time. But, you know, the House is such a different place than when she first had this job. And a big part of it is that there are so many more women.
Such a change in just a dozen years. Sung Min, in about 20, 25 seconds we have left, there's also a strong, progressive, boisterous voice within Nancy Pelosi's caucus. How much is that going to pull her to the left? And how much is she going to try to temper that to get things through?
It's certainly going to test her leadership skills. And what a major example of that is the question of impeachment that's going to hang over basically every single day of this new Congress and of the Trump presidency. Democrats don't want to pursue that primarily, but there is a liberal faction that is agitating for it. And that's a push and pull that we'll have to watch.
Sung Min Kim, Janet Hook, Jack Beatty, and you. We want all of you to stick around. We're talking about a government invigorated by a newly sworn in Congress and yet mired in the throes of a shutdown. You can join our conversation. How should the U.S. approach border security? What effects of the shutdown are you seeing in your communities? How would you like to Congress to operate? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about a new year and a new week in the news. You can join our conversation about the president's new cabinet and about his approach to governing as he now has to take Democratic leaders into account. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined this hour by a terrific panel of guests. Sung Min Kim, she's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Los Angeles Times. And our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. First, I want to turn to your calls. We're getting a bunch of them. We've got a call now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Harrison is calling. I understand, Harrison, you want to talk about the nature of the new Congress itself.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It just seems like that not every outlet, but there's some news outlets that make it seem like America is racist. And, you know, I like to state that I am a black American male. But it seems like the white American male is like on the attack. Like it's a bad thing if you have so many white males in leadership. Whereas if you look at governments across the world, all over the world, we are the most diverse by far. If you go to China, their whole government is going to be full of Chinamen. If you go to Russia, it's all Russianmen. If you go to Europe, it's all, you know, white Europeans. But in America, we have so many women. We have so much diversity. But we still have people complaining about it, like we have a race issue, and we're the most diverse nation in the world. I don't see how that's still a problem.
Or
that's
how you can reconcile the two things, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Harrison. Jack Beatty, what about that? There is a talk about a focus on the question of the, let's say, the whiteness of the Republican caucus and the question of hostility to women and people of color, and this color points out that we seem to be making some progress. Indeed, of course, we had America's first African-American president not so many years ago.
Yes, and all that is encouraging. Against it, though, needs to be set the data that Elizabeth Warren cited in her announcement of her exploratory committee, she cited the wealth gap between white families and black families. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it's pretty, pretty dramatic. And that is to say, yes, there is, you know, on the surface, you can see lots of variety and the American mosaic is represented. But when you start to look at the economics and you start to look at the life chances of African Americans, it is a stark difference between the life chances of an African American child and a white child, just simply in virtue of the wealth gap between their families. And of course, that going back to decades of deprivation on the part of African Americans. So yes, there's encouraging things to see, but underneath the economics, the sense of fairness, that injustice remains.
I want to take a call now from Dayton, Ohio. Tushar, what are you thinking when you think about this Congress?
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I really have just two quick points, and they're more for the constituencies of this newly elected freshman class. I think first-time Democratic voters need to temper their expectations of immediate consequence because they need to remember the other half of Congress is led by an individual who filibustered his own bill. And then going along with that point, with the expectations of 2020 and the excitement that a lot of voters are having about going to the polls, they need to remember that the minority party in Congress and the majority party in the Senate really can't be taken as good faith actors when considering questions of the majority, i.e. the constituency, i.e. the American people writ large, their interests at writ large.
Well, thank you for that, Tushar. Janet Hook, you know, you think about what the Democrats are doing, the expectations in Democratic voters. You got to imagine that's on the mind of the president. Shortly before we went on the air, he's often known to tweet his sort of subtitles, what he's thinking, right? The president tweeted, "How do you impeach a president who has won perhaps the greatest election of all time, done nothing wrong, no collusion with Russia, it was Dems that colluded, had the most successful 2 years of any president, and is the most popular Republican in party history, 93%. Janet Hook, to what expectation is there that Democratic oversight will turn the screws on the Trump presidencies? What expectation is that the word impeachment will become part of the vernacular up there?
Well, this is one part of the expectations that Nancy Pelosi and a lot of other senior Democrats have worked pretty hard to tamp down even before they won control of the House. They're hoping that while they're planning to launch plenty of investigations and will probably uncover lots of things that the Trump administration would rather not be out there, what they're really waiting for is the report from the Mueller investigation. And in the meantime, they really are trying to not make it sound like the measure of their success is whether or not they impeach Donald Trump, because it's not likely to result in his removal since the Republicans still control the Senate, and they're balancing the demands of the expectations of their political base against the political risks of running an impeachment proceeding that doesn't actually remove the president.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller now from Denver, Colorado, who has a question for our panel. Nick, go ahead.
Hi, David. Love the show.
Oh, great.
My question is, a few months ago, the president got his wall funding, and Schumer got help for DACA. So they had a compromise on the table. And from my understanding, the president turned that down. And maybe some can answer this question. I'm wondering who the president talked to and why he changed his mind.
Terrific, Nick. And you're referring, of course, to Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader, senator from New York. Thanks so much for that question, Nick. Let me turn to Sungmin Kim. You cover the Washington Post, for the Washington Post, you cover the White House through the lens of Capitol Hill. Who turned that down? There seemed to be a deal on the table. What went awry there?
Well, definitely Chuck Schumer came away from this private lunch between just him and the president and their respective chiefs of staff early last year, thinking that they had a deal. And it was actually a pretty good deal, the Democrats thought, at least from the president's perspective, because it offered $25 billion in wall funding. I mean, we're talking about $5 billion that Trump wants right now. I mean, Schumer was willing to give him $25 billion in wall funding in exchange for permanent protection for Dreamers. But the two men left that lunch, and the reporting at the time showed that there were some messages back from the White House saying this is a deal that the president can no longer take. And obviously, we know there are several influences in the White House who did not think this was a good deal at the time. One was the former chief of staff, John Kelly, who left his position a couple of days ago, and the senior advisor in the White House, Stephen Miller, who is deeply entrenched in immigration issues. This is a policy that he's worked long on, has very hardline views on immigration. But a lot of people have said in retrospect that that may have been the president's last best chance at getting all that wall funding that he wanted. And not only that, but there was also a bipartisan agreement cashed out among a lot of Republican senators as well as Democrats that did also provide $25 billion plus a litany of other plus the protections for the Dreamers and some other immigration changes that Democrats say got at the legal immigration changes that the president and the administration wanted at the time. But his administration worked to essentially defeat that legislation in the Senate, basically whipped Republican votes against that deal and killed it as well. Consistently, the administration has said whatever the Democrats and some of the dealmaker Republicans have offered up for a wall or for in exchange for the wall funding that the president has wanted doesn't go far enough in other areas. And I think now the political dynamic have turned a little bit. The Dreamer population, who this primarily affects, have said they don't want to be used as bargaining chips for a wall that they philosophically opposed. Obviously, the courts have also stepped in and have given these DACA protections or the DACA recipients a temporary reprieve. So those permits are still valid as we speak, although that could change once the Supreme Court steps in. And Nancy Pelosi has also said that she would not do a permanent, wall for DACA exchange. And that is really reflective of kind of where the mood of the caucus is right now, that they believe that the wall is a symbol for something that they don't support, that they don't think America should be, and they're not willing to give the president money for that.
I want to take a call now from Des Moines, Iowa, about the argument about the wall. Larry, what's your thinking about the president's border proposals?
Great show. Thank you for bringing this topic up. I think it's a bit ironic that Nancy Pelosi lives in California in a really nice house with a great big 8-foot wall all the way around that for her security, for her to be able to keep out criminals and undesirables that she doesn't want on her property. But yet she comes back and denies the rest of us Americans that privilege. She is denying us border security. And again, I'm not anti-immigrant. I'm not anti-anything. I simply think that you would not build a house and not put a front door on your house. And right
so
now,
I wanna,
that's exactly what we
Larry,
have.
Larry, stay on the line with me for a second, but I want to push back just a little bit. So there is a picture of a mansion in San Francisco's wealthy Pacific Heights neighborhood that is making the rounds on social media, and it's a gorgeous house. That picture, if it's the one that I'm thinking of, doesn't actually belong to Nancy Pelosi, however. There was a virtual tour of the mansion published in Forbes magazine in 2013, and the article mentions Nancy Pelosi because she lives pretty nearby. But that mansion with the wall doesn't belong to her, and this analysis was done by, among others, the folks at the fact-checking site Snopes. Just want to see, does your support for the wall, is it contingent on Pelosi having the wall, which her house does not, or is it a broader support there?
It's absolutely a security issue for the United States. As I said, you would not build a house and not put a door on your house. And right now we have a wonderful house in this country, but we have no door on the house.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Larry. I appreciate that very much. Sungmin Kim, there is seemingly support on the Democratic side for border security, right? They're willing to put up money for that, but it's really all coming down to the question of a wall. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. And in terms of the analogy of the door on the front house that your caller gave, and also the security on the border. I mean, we do have ports of entry that are guarded by experienced personnel that do open the gates and close the gates for the cars and the trucks that are coming in. But setting that aside, Democrats have said over and over that they do support border security, but they don't want to do it in what they call a quote medieval wall. So you talk about repairing some of the fencing that's already existing on the border. They talk a lot about improving technology and drones, sensors, things like that, kind of bringing border security into the 21st century. Will Hurd, who's a Republican from Texas who represents a massive border district, has also talked extensively about border security in that sense, and not necessarily a wall. And a bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform bill that Senate Democrats and several Republicans backed in 2013 did include a lot of these elements, you know, a border wall, hundreds of miles of new fencing, lots of new border patrol agents to have more boots on the ground. It was interesting. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who was in that Situation Room briefing earlier this week, talking about border security, said he mentioned to the rest of the group that, look, we need just more people to be able to scan vehicles coming into the country to scan them for narcotics, because we don't do that right now. Like, that's border security. So Democrats say they are for various measures to figure out to just improve border security measures, but it's this idea of a concrete wall all along the southern border that they cannot get behind.
And of course, we should remember the effects of the shutdown affect, many hundreds of thousands of federal employees, but also services, national parks. Ironically, the ability to process checks for employers on people's immigration status, as reported by my colleague Joel Rose at NPR, and often affecting people, particularly in Native American communities, who argue with legal reason that the U.S. is failing to live up to its treaties with their tribes as a result of a lot of services being shut down. I want to turn for the last few minutes of this segment to a cabinet meeting that the president held this week, just prior to the swearing in of the new Congress, at which the president made news by what he said rather than anything that was announced. Among the things that were notable, harsh words about former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis during the cabinet meeting, in which Trump said he had essentially fired Mattis, who had actually resigned in protest of the president's policies.
But what's he done for me? How has he done in Afghanistan? Not too good. Not too good. I'm not happy with what he's done in Afghanistan, and I shouldn't be happy. But he was very happy. He was very thankful when I got him $700 billion, and then the following year, $716 billion. So, I mean, I wish him well. I hope he does well. But as you know, President Obama fired him, and essentially so did I. I want results.
What's he done for me? The president asked. Here's what Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker had to say about President Trump during a cabinet meeting Wednesday, in which the people assembled were supposed to be talking about how they were addressing the shutdown and how they were taking up the obligations of government.
Mr. President, I will start by highlighting the fact that you stayed in Washington, D.C. over the holidays, giving up Christmas with your family, New Year's with your family, trying to bring an end to this shutdown and security to our southern border, while some members of Congress went on vacation and ignored the problem. You have demonstrated your dedication to delivering on this critical issue for our country and for the American people.
Janet Hook, what do you make of the nation's top law enforcement official speaking in this laudatory fashion towards the president at that moment?
Well, that's kind of what people who are in the cabinet do, is they praise Trump. But we've seen some remarkable examples of people heading to the exit with some not so flattering things to say. You know, we heard from John Kelly and Jim Mattis. I was actually struck by Trump's question, what did Mattis do for him? I mean, one thing that Mattis did for him so long as he was in the cabinet was he was reassuring to a lot of Republicans and foreign policy and defense people who wanted to make sure that there was an adult in the room, so to speak. And, you know, when he quit in protest over Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria in a rather rapid fashion, he was reflecting the anxieties of a lot of other Republicans. I mean, to the extent that Trump could say he fired him, it was just that he told him to get out the door by January 1st rather than taking through the month. So, I mean, I think Mattis...
You can't quit on me. I'm going to fire you.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I don't know.
And to your point, Janet, you know, we have an alert now that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is going to travel to the Middle East next week in an effort to shore up support from America's Arab partners as tensions arise in the region about the American stance there. We are discussing a new year with new challenges and possible challengers to President Trump. You can join our conversation. We'll turn to Republican Senator Mitt Romney's rebuke of the president and Elizabeth Warren's own White House aspirations. We'd love to hear your questions and your impressions, although perhaps not your comedic impressions. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. It's officially 2019, but political watchers are already looking to 2020. You can join our conversation here on Folkenflik Friday. We'll be talking about Mitt Romney's presidential rebuke, Elizabeth Warren's presidential aspirations, and a roller coaster economy. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined this hour by Sungmin Kim. She's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Janet Hook, national political reporter for The Los Angeles Times, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, I wanted to turn for a moment for some of the comments the president has made about our involvements abroad. The president at one point said, hey, look, you know, in terms of Syria, you know, I may delay how quickly I remove our troops from there, but Iran can basically do what it wants in Syria for all I care. And on Afghanistan, at that cabinet meeting that we just discussed a few moments ago, the president basically said, hey, you know, there was terrorism. The Soviets essentially, you know, lost their empire and the Soviet Union itself cracked up because they had to invade Afghanistan and they had to do that and it was the right call to do. You know, I don't remember too many Russian leaders praising us for getting into Vietnam over the years. What do you make about these comments by the president?
Well, on Afghanistan, isn't it interesting that just now the Russian Duma should be moving to rehabilitate the Afghan war? There, it had under Gorbachev, it had been, you know, denounced as a great mistake of in the perestroika era, a great mistake of Soviet foreign policy. Now the Duma is saying, hold a minute, it was successful, it wasn't so bad. Just as Mr. Trump is saying the same thing, you have to wonder, do they have the same source? Namely, did Vladimir Putin put this nonsense in his sort of filter in his ear? And about the Middle East, my gosh, you know, what must Israel think when he says, "I'll let Iran take it"? You know, it's all sand and blood. Well, some of that sand abuts Israel, and mm-hmm. Do we really want Iran to be right there? Benjamin Netanyahu must have just been perplexed, to say the least, by that. But, you know, that was typical of this 90-minute ramble. I mean, the president, he filled the air with falsehood and flapdoodle, just stuff pulled out of the air about rooms full of computer keyboards and about the perfidy of allies and about, I know more about drones and I would be a great general. And the whole thing, in any other context would have been singularly alarming. You'd say, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with this man. With Mr. Trump, that's just the texture of a Trump day. He just goes on and seems to be in his own world.
You know, in that great Venn diagram of words that are synonyms for untruths and words that you can say on public radio, I think flapdoodle stands at the dead center of the overlap. I wanted to turn now to folks who are thinking about the president, thinking about the leadership he provides. One of the most prominent newly sworn in senator from Utah, Mitt Romney. He wrote an op-ed highly critical of President Trump. And he, in speaking with CNN's Jake Tapper on Wednesday, he explained why.
He has said during the campaign that he could be extraordinary presidential. When I hear that, I think of Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson and Roosevelt and Kennedy and Eisenhower, and I think of those qualities. And while he spoke of that, and while that was my hope, I don't think he's followed through on that front the way he's followed through on some of his other promises.
Sungmin Kim, Senator Romney also said he intends essentially to be voting for the president's priorities on Capitol Hill. What role is the former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney sketching out for himself as he joins Congress? And why is he doing it?
He's clearly there's clearly a vacuum of these prominent Trump critic voices because the two major or the three major Republican senators who had filled that role in the last Congress are no longer there. Senators Bob Corker of Tennessee and Jeff Flake of Arizona have now retired and are no longer senators. And obviously, Senator John McCain of Arizona passed away last year. So there's a space for someone to be that voice, and clearly Mitt Romney brings with him a national platform that was gained by his presidential run in 2012, and that and his frequent criticisms of Trump, you know, throughout the campaign. But I found his op-ed and his subsequent comments on CNN and just how he's already embraced this anti-Trump voice pretty interesting, because there has been kind of this tradition among high-profile incoming freshman senators in the past to kind of keep their head down and really focus on local issues or state issues and not kind of abuse the big national platform that they have already at the outset. I'm thinking of former senators such as Al Franken and former Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton herself, yeah. Because they do want to be seen as someone who tends to their state. So this tactic is certainly not that. So it'll be really interesting to see how Senator Romney kind of balances the critiques and also the deeds of his state versus the national versus kind of having to scale back and support the president's policies. And look, the Senator Romney has snagged a seat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So that gives him an even bigger platform to criticize the president on matters of foreign policy and national security, and those are the issues where we so often have seen these clashes between kind of these classic traditional Republicans on Capitol Hill and the Trump administration, obviously, and the president himself, particularly thinking of matters of Russia. So that'll be an interesting confrontation to watch in the coming 2 years.
I mean, I will say, Sungmin, that it seems to me that in decades past, you would have these figures, whether conservative Democrats or more moderate Republicans, who would not only lend their voice to critiquing a White House's position, but vote against those priorities that set by the White House. It seems to me that one of the interesting things about the modern point, when you look at Corker and Flake, often Susan Collins, with maybe the exception of Lisa Murkowski, by and large, the president was getting their votes pretty reliably. You know, it was not a huge variation from the norm there, right? So that there's this almost this kind of intellectual distinction between voice and vote.
That's a fair point. I would also point out, too, though, that because I see this pop up a lot among critics of the Republican Party, obviously Democrats and progressives, that how can you give these critiques to the president when you are voting with these policies, you know, 80, 90, 95% of the time? And I think a point that kind of gets lost there sometimes is that these are Republicans. I mean, they philosophically support lower taxes. They support conservative justices.
But what you're saying is in some ways they're conservative Republicans, because it seems to me as though there aren't too many folks that fit what used to be and maybe Janet Hook, you can weigh in here. But there aren't too many folks that fit what used to be the idea of, hey, the parties at times overlap or touch or kiss in terms of their ideology at the edges. Like, that's not happening, right?
Right. Well, and also you have to take a careful look at what has happened to the Republican Party as a result of the 2018 election. I mean, the Senate now is almost wall-to-wall Trump loyalists, people who don't want to speak out. As you noted, there's the ones that had been speaking out, Corker, McCain, Flake, are not there anymore. In the House, all of the centrists that remained who might have voted against Trump either retired or were defeated in the Democratic wipeout. I mean, it's a very Trumpy Congress, a very Trumpy Republican Party in Congress right now. And I think that what you hear in Romney is, yes, he may vote with the president, but he reflects an anxiety that a lot of Republicans have that the tone, they may agree with Trump on policy, but the tone that he sets is a risk to the party, that he's hurting the party more by his style of leadership than the goals that he's setting. I think actually that one of the most interesting things that Romney said in that CNN interview was, well, when asked directly, he said that no, he wasn't planning on running against Trump in the 2020 Republican primary, but that he was going to wait and see who might, and that, you know, he wouldn't endorse Trump until he figured out whether there was somebody better running against him. I thought that was pretty. I can't think of any Republican as prominent as him that has said something like that so plainly.
Floyd is calling from Ottumwa, Iowa. Floyd, what are your thoughts on Mitt Romney?
You know, I think he does have a great chance to push back against President Trump because, you know, you talked earlier about these other senators coming in, keeping a low profile. They don't want to ruffle too many feathers. They want to help their constituents. But, you know, Mitt Romney has a base there in the state of Utah, almost entirely Latter-day Saints or Mormon. But also, that Latter-day Saint base reaches outside of the state of Utah. He has people that also remember his father. You know, Romney was the governor of Michigan, and his father, the one that was the...
George Romney, yes.
Father, George Romney. Uh-huh. He also ran a company that came back from the brink, and that fella, he almost ran, almost won, as I recall... Was it 1968? He almost won
He did pretty well in the primaries until he said he had been brainwashed about the Vietnam War, if memory serves.
Right.
But yeah, you know, no, he's notable pushback, figure.
But this business about pushback, I'm going to let you take on because I want to hear your comments. But he does have a base plus to push back. He could be the next president of the United States. That is Mitt Romney. Let me hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Floyd. And worth noting, of course, Mitt Romney was also the governor of the state of Massachusetts and a moderate Republican governor at that stretch. So it sounds to me what you're saying, Janet Hook, is that it's quite possible that that we see Mitt Romney put his head above the parapet if significant players don't come aboard in that race. I want to turn to another senator from Massachusetts in this case who has declared her interest in the 2020 race. That, of course, Elizabeth Warren. She announced her campaign, or at least her exploratory committee, on New Year's Eve, becoming the first major Democrat to enter. Here she was talking about her campaign in an interview with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow this Wednesday.
This isn't about me. This is about tens of millions of families across this country who are getting cheated. And they're getting cheated on financial products. They're getting cheated on prescription drugs, a Washington that works great for drug companies, not for people who are trying to fill prescriptions. You can just keep going through the list. It's working great for oil companies that want to drill everywhere, not for families who have children that want to breathe the air. This is truly about what kind of a country we're going to be.
Janet Hook, how strong, how formidable a candidate would Elizabeth Warren be?
Quite strong. It really was a very important announcement. I mean, we're expecting, dozens of Democrats are thinking about running. A couple of lesser-known people have announced. But Elizabeth Warren really is the most prominent Democrat to step in and formally. Now, it wasn't a surprise because, you know, we'd been seeing all kinds of movement in her camp that showed that she was preparing to announce. She'd been staffing up. She'd been very involved in supporting other Democrats in the midterm elections. And she has, except for you know, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, if they decide to run, she probably has the highest national profile and constituency, political constituency of any of the people thinking about it at the starting line. You know, with her greater prominence comes, you know, she enters the race with more negatives that she has to cope with. But she really, you know, and she's going to Iowa this weekend. I mean, she's really, it's with such a big field about to emerge, there's a great advantage to stepping out early. And there was really not much percentage in her playing coy any longer.
Mm-hmm. Populist appeal, but from the left, from Elizabeth Warren. Jim is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, how does the Warren candidacy strike you?
Well, Dave, I don't think she has really a shot becoming the nominee because I think her tone just becomes off as too much of an angry one.
Her tone.
The Democrats need to, right. The Democrats need to pick a more positive, legitimate candidate, and I don't know who that would be. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Sung Min, one of the things that we saw in some of the conversation and coverage of Elizabeth Warren was the question of likability that came up. And it was one of these things that you heard about Nancy Pelosi, one of these things you hear about Hillary Clinton. How often do we hear that about male candidates?
I think there's been coverage of some male candidates who don't with certain reputations who have had that likability issue. I saw a tweet from a former staffer for Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, who has clearly like made waves since he burst in the national spotlight. And I mean, I've been on the Hill for 7 years. I mean, that likability issue has come up with Ted Cruz, particularly among his own Republican colleagues. But I do think that this is something that rises to the occasion more often with women. I think it's perhaps, you know, I don't have real great insights beyond just perhaps that us reporters may kind of just keep that in perspective. But it's definitely something that, you know, fair or not, female candidates for president are going to have to deal with. And there's a lot in the field right now. I mean, we talk about Elizabeth Warren, who has announced her exploratory committee, and we're expecting announcements very soon, perhaps in just the next couple of weeks or so, from several other prominent potential female candidates, even just several among Senator Warren's own colleagues on Capitol Hill. We're looking at Kamala Harris of California, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. And this is, you know, obviously, they're looking at kind of the lessons of the Hillary Clinton campaign and I'm drawing some sort of lessons from that, I'm sure.
Want to end the hour by noting, you know, we've had a turbulent financial time. The market's going up and down and off and down. The chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors telling CNN it's not just going to be Apple hit. I think there are a heck of a lot of U.S. companies that have a lot of sales in China that are basically going to be watching their earnings downgraded over the next year. And yet we saw today, this morning, the announcement that the U.S. economy picked up 312,000 jobs in December, an incredibly robust announcement. The Labor Department, despite the shutdown, still being open. Sung Min Kim of The Washington Post, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Janet Hook of The LA Times, such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And many thanks to On Point's own Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
If you're looking for another way to stay connected to On Point, you can subscribe to our newsletter right on our homepage at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Down, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poley, James Wasson, Alex Schroeder, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Rushing. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.